Hi, I'm Jesse Driscoll. I'm here with Christian Davenport, and we're bringing you the Raiders of the Lost Archive. Archives are repositories of special information. Archives can take many forms, historical documents, oral histories, or data sets that can't just be downloaded. We're asking questions to allow some special guests to speak candidly about their research process. The conversations will be archived here for the social science community. Thanks for listening, and enjoy. So, Zachariah, how would you introduce yourself?
I am the Marx Chair of International Affairs at the Marx School of Public and International Affairs at the City University of New York.
So you have spent a lot of time doing a lot of different kinds of field work. But when you got started at the very beginning, what was the topic or question that you were interested in examining for your first research project?
So I started my PhD 7 days after 9/11, which is about to celebrate 20 years now. And so it was very much a time in which you had sort of a very dominant paradigm of terrorism studies growing in the academy. And certainly that infected my PhD program as well. And so, you know, I think as a young PhD student, I was interested in the question of terrorism, but more from a critical bent. I was skeptical of the sense that, you know, these movements that I was interested in were either terrorists or, as was common in the academy at the time, were these sort of criminal bandits. And so I wanted to go and study these groups, but not from the perspective of, say, the U.S. national security establishment, but from the perspective of local communities and actual members of these groups, which became the main focus of my dissertation.
So for those of us who know your work, this is going to be a little deep background, but for many people who are listening who aren't, what are you loading into the term these groups? I mean, I know what they're not to you. They're not criminals and they're not terrorists, but, you know, what either give us some proper nouns or give us some descriptors of what you think the groups are.
So the groups that I was initially interested in were very much African revolutionary groups, like groups that were operating in Eastern Congo at the time. The mid-90s obviously were a time in which a lot of groups were emerging in the eastern part of the country. And I had some personal connections to one of the founders of a group called the RCD in Eastern Congo, a man named Ernest Wamba Diawamba, who I studied with as a student at the University of Dar es Salaam in the late 90s.
So you were his student?
I was his student in 97, 98, and then he became the president of the RCD in August of 98. So I studied with him right before he went off to start his new career as a rebel leader.
What did he teach?
He taught a year-long seminar on Central African history. From a Marxist perspective, which was super fascinating.
Charismatic? Was he good in the classroom?
Wamba Diawamba was sadly, you know, late Wamba Diawamba was one of the smartest individuals I've ever encountered in my academic career, and sort of held up in very high regard by, I think, African intellectuals especially, but around the world as well as such. It's unfortunate in some ways that his legacy is tarnished by his participation in the RCD. But intellectually, he was a first-rate figure and really fundamentally shifted my thinking, especially about, you know, class and class relations by applying them to an African context, which was very distinctive and I think will remain influential.
I had a question. Wow. Okay, so hold on one second. So one, do you still have syllabi from that class? You do?
You know, I didn't hear the question. It kind of dropped out at the end.
Right. I was saying, do you still have syllabi from that class?
Oh, I wish I did. Maybe I should look it up. It's been quite a while. And back then it was all paper, so I'm sure it exists somewhere.
As an archivist, I'm very interested in that type of stuff, especially when we have folks in the classroom that you wouldn't normally anticipate. But my actual question was, so as you were gearing up in the kind of post 9/11 environment to think about going to the field, what were people telling you?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. You know, I had some struggles as a PhD student, and I ended up losing the initial advisor that I went to work with, who was Ed Keller, who was a scholar of Ethiopian Marxist groups, and ended up working with Michael Ross, who at the time was just sort of relatively new to UCLA. And hadn't even gotten tenure at that point. And I, what I liked about Michael a lot is that even though the kind of work that I was doing was you know, in some ways oppositional to the kind of approach he was taking, he very much encouraged me to just go into the field and see what I could find. And my whole proposal had been, I want to study these groups from the perspective of local civilian communities. And so he was, you know, I think, quite wary of whether I would be able to access the populations I was saying I was going to access. And then also, I think, legitimately concerned that I might get caught up in sort of the war on terror, which at the time was you know, demarcating some of the groups I was interested in as terrorist organizations like the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka.
I think both of those concerns are salient. I mean, as someone who is now on the other side of the desk and advising students all the time, I sympathize with Michael, but I'm glad you're here. So how did you skirt that? Did you, you know, kind of take that advice in tow and then just do your own thing? Or did you communicate with Michael and back and forth about it and change the research design at all? Or what?
We're all about
That's a great question. For me, you know, my first draft of the proposal, so at UCLA, you know, we had to pass our two exams and then you have to do a proposal defense. There's no actual formal dissertation defense, so it's all about the proposal. And I went to Michael after finishing my coursework and my field papers with a draft of the proposal. And it was very much a political economy of rebel governance. You know, that was the fashion at the time. Paul Collier's work was hugely influential. Michael himself was making some seminal contributions in that literature at the moment. And my whole take was, you know, I'm going to apply a political economy approach to the study of rebel governance, which was a field that, you know, had some antecedents, but hadn't really been developed in any sort of formal way since probably the 1970s. And so, you know, Michael actually did something unusual, which is he said, you know, I don't think you're ready to defend your proposal yet, and you should go and do pre-dissertation research. So go out into the field first to see if you can actually do what you say you're going to do, and then come back and we'll have your proposal defense after you've already done some field work. And I think for me, that was, you know, it was disappointing advice in some ways because it seemed to inhibit my progress through the program, but it was also really useful advice because I went into the field and what I realized after spending, you know, 6 months traveling between these three different field sites is that the political economy approach did not work for the question I was trying to answer, and that I wanted to actually make my dissertation a critique of political economy approaches to understanding rebel behavior. So I don't think I would have had that insight had I not actually gone off and done this fieldwork before actually getting approved to start the dissertation research.
So give me a quick anecdote. I'm sure you have dozens of these, but a quick anecdote that's either funny or tragic about why the political economy approach didn't work, either because it was absurd in its application, or because the human costs of round peg square holing it were too great in terms of representational violence to your subjects.
You know, it's really hard to convey the power of that paradigm in that moment. You know, in the early 2000s, there was, you know, obviously the work coming out of Oxford, Paul Collier and crew, but, you know, Paul Collier wasn't just an academic thinker. He was also somebody who was advising the World Bank. So it very quickly moved into the policy realm. You know, it even moved into the cultural sphere. So if you remember at that time, you had the movie Blood Diamonds that came out. You had Kanye West with his, you know, track Diamonds from Sierra Leone. So there was a whole kind of public conversation that really viewed all of these movements as essentially, you know, bandits or, you know, as we discussed, as terrorists for different reasons. And I think one thing that I was really kind of naive about when I first went into the field was that I assumed it would be really obvious to me that this is how they were operating. Right. And I went into the field and I was just sort of overwhelmed by, you know, honestly, the level of comfort between NGOs, international organizations like the United Nations, and rebel leaders, right? Because in my head, especially coming from the United States, I had imagined them all as these sort of hooded, you know, fierce warrior types, and not this sort of disaffected group of you know, ragtag bunch of academics, businessmen, you know, opportunists and others who were very willing to engage with the UN, very open to talking to NGOs who had very close relationships to figures in government. And that kind of blew me away because my whole perception had been shaped, I think, largely by the coursework I took in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, where I'd come to think of them as you know, almost these sort of superhuman, demon-like figures. And then to realize that, especially in Eastern Congo or South Sudan, that they were often, you know, former academics, failed business people, you know, idealists struggling to kind of improve their countries, you know, really kind of disavowed me of my assumptions fairly rapidly and forced me to reconsider the politics of what was actually happening in these spaces.
I mean, actually, your characterization is quite interesting, Zachariah. So two-parter in many respects. So you were kind of committed methodologically. You were going to like, I'm going to go do interviews. You were committed up front, but you were going to do interviews with what you described as these superhuman beings. I'm like, how does one how does one prepare for that type of engagement? It's just like, okay, you know, you want to talk to people, and your characterization of these people was this other thing as opposed to the thing that you actually ended up interviewing. So one, how do you prepare for interacting with superhuman beings? And second, when did the kind of humanization part kick in? When were you just kind of like, how'd you get to them? How'd you get to these superhuman beings, right? So,
yeah, so the short answer is that, you know, I had done a master's at Columbia prior to starting my PhD program in political science. And when I was at Columbia, even though I was technically in the political science department, I took all my classes in anthropology and history, right? And Columbia was very strong at that time in post-colonial studies, and I'd been introduced to these concepts of the subaltern and, you know, work by Ranajit Guha and others about peasant insurgency, right? And then I went to UCLA and I started studying political violence, you know, in a much more formal way. And almost all of that literature had been excluded from kind of the paradigms that we were being exposed to in American political science department. There was almost no conversation between what post-colonial studies had been doing and the sort of new literature on greed and grievance and civil war. And so I think when I went into the field, I realized very quickly that, you know, actually, I don't need to talk to, you know, the rebel leader or the government minister, that I'm as interested in kind of the low level, low ranking cadre who are participating in these movements. And I'm especially interested in ordinary civilians who are just living in these spaces, right? So very quickly, my research, which initially had been kind of focused on getting these elite interviews, kind of morphed into saying, you know what, actually the stories I want to hear and the stories I want to focus on are the stories of the ordinary people, right? The low-level figures who may be, you know, fruit sellers by day and fighters by night. You know, the school teachers or the doctors who somehow have made arrangements with the rebel groups, who may have family members who are participating in these rebellions. But actually, I found to be much more interesting because they were trying to, you know, do much more mundane, banal activities like educate people or, you know, provide some semblance of healthcare. And so I, you know, that was a kind of pivotal moment for me, was to realize that there actually had been a lot of theoretical work done in post-colonial studies and subaltern studies, which really said that these are important stories to tell and that you can learn a lot about larger political trends by avoiding the tendency to focus on the big men and rather foregrounding, you know, communities that traditionally have been excluded from, I'd say, political science scholarship more generally.
But your sampling on the way in, I mean, the way that you described the selection of the sites was based on access through a big man, right? So how did you, I guess it's a two-part question. The first is, how did you select the other two sites? Which is, I guess, kind of a design question. And then the second is that did that access that you had through the University Dar es Salaam make it easier or harder to access the place where you already felt like you knew the big man?
Yeah, so let me be clear. I mean, you know, Wamba Diawamba was nominally the president of the RCD, but his tenure lasted less than a year, and he was displaced by the more militaristic elements. He himself had no prior military background, and so he was part of a group of academics who were appointed into this political role, but who never had any control over the military organization. And so that by 98, he had been displaced as president and really had kind of just emerged as a gadfly trying to push the negotiations between the rebels and the government in particular directions, but exercised no control over the larger military organization. So, you know, by the time I got into the field, which was around 2002, To be frank, Wamba was not a political player anymore. He did not have any influence over the armed forces. There were armed groups that were fighting in eastern Congo, and I didn't use him as a connection to help me get into these areas, partly because his name didn't really carry a lot of weight. I mean, he was kind of a despised figure, especially in eastern Congo, where I was conducting research, because the RCD had engaged in a lot of very brutal attacks on civilian communities. And so there was no value added for me to have connections to a deposed president of this organization, of this relatively hated organization. So then I had to kind of pivot and sort of figure out, who are the actors who are actually operating in these areas, and how might I be able to gain access, right? So for each of the cases, which were Eastern Congo, Southern Sudan, and Northern Sri Lanka, a lot of my initial travels in the region were just spent just trying to figure out how to get into these spaces, right? And ultimately, I end up, in each case, relying on a different set of actors. In Sri Lanka, it was the Tamil diaspora. They had been doing a lot of relief work in Sri Lanka, in coordination with the LTTE and through the kind of humanitarian wing that was controlled by members of the diaspora. They gave me access to those sites. In Southern Sudan, it was really, I was living in Kampala at the time, and there were a lot of SPLA commanders used to hang out at a coffee shop in Kampala. And so I just walked up to one of them and started talking to him. And that was after a month or two of trying to get permission through more official channels and being rejected. And then finally, somebody, a journalist actually said, there's a group of SPLA commanders. If you go to this one cafe in Kampala, and you'll recognize them right away because they'll be taller and darker than everybody else there. And that was obviously a stereotype, but a stereotype that was very useful in that moment, because I walked into this cafe and there was a group of Sudanese-looking men sitting around having tea. And I walked up to them and they were very happy to talk. I mean, that's again, that was a surprise part, because you had this assumption about who they were. And they instead were like, let us tell you the story. We can help you get in. Tell us what you need. And they were the ones who facilitated my visit to South Sudan for the first time. Eastern Congo was much, much more difficult in some ways, because there was no actual authority operating in that region at the time I was doing my field work. And the only way I could get in at the time, the UN would allow people to petition for access to their flights, which were the only flights going into Eastern Congo at the time. And eventually the UN had to shut that down because people were using it to funnel drugs and other illicit goods in and out of the region. But I was like on one of the last flights where they allowed a random ass PhD student to get on. And they just literally dropped me off at the airport in Goma, and were like, okay, you're on your own now. So in each case, it was just a combination of circumstance and luck, rather than any sort of real connection of people. So again, the 9/11 context is really important here, right? So this is a time in which you had the Human Train Systems Program being put in place. There were a lot of young PhD students and young academics who were, riding along with the U.S. military, were wearing, camouflage outfits, wearing, just really taking on that idea that the academy was part of the U.S. military apparatus. And so that was the route in which many other scholars were gaining access to these insurgent-controlled areas. But again, for me, I didn't want to be seen as riding along with the military. So, I had to figure out alternate ways of accessing these sites. And retrospectively, I wouldn't advise any graduate students to pursue that approach anymore. But at the time, it did work for me.
I got two things. One is kind of like, I want to circle back to a comment you made, and then kind of it's to provide context to our listeners, but also to kind of understand the significance of your pivot. So like in the early 2000s, right, it's this kind of rationalist homogenization of these institutions, of the challenging institutions and so forth, and even governments for that sake. So to make the subaltern move in that context is huge, when everyone's just kind of simplifying the kind of decision tree and all this other thing. And you're kind of going in and be like, okay, yeah, there is a pyramid, but there's a whole bunch of people that are in it. And actually, this might be more informative down here. And so I just want to kind of to get to that. And your characterization of how you made that pivot, because the whole literature is like leading to the top of the pyramid, right? And then you tell me, you tell us that you go in and you're kind of like, oh, so this is a huge pivot away from where most of the literature is and most of the understanding. And your background in anthropology and history seemed to be incredibly useful for making that pivot. So I just wanted to kind of contextualize that, because it sounded part happenstance the way you were saying it, but also there's an intellectual shift that came from this grounding. So it's partly your exposure to other areas that sensitized you to this openness, and then opportunism. So I just kind of wanted to, does that sound right in terms of the characterization?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a language that we used to use, and then it became kind of derogatory of the soak and poke, right? Of mm-hmm. sort of really embedding yourself in a region, walking around, just talking to ordinary people, letting happenstance play a role in the research process. And obviously, I think there's all kinds of critiques we can level against that sort of approach, especially in its sort of non-systematic approach to gathering data. Creates real, blind spots in terms of the kinds of stuff that we're hoping to study in a systematic fashion. That being said, if you again remember the early 2000s, it was a time in which areas that were outside the control of the state had an entire nomenclature that emphasized their unknowability, right? So the Rand Corporation, I was living in LA, Rand Corporation was in Santa Monica. At that time, they released a study and it was called Black Spots, right? And it was referring to areas of the map that were controlled by insurgent groups. Academics had a whole set of language to describe areas that were outside of the control of the state. That goes back to the founding of Western political theory when you think about Hobbes and the Leviathan. And so, in these sort of low information spaces, right, I think where we pretty much know nothing and the entire society or life in these areas is replaced by a set of suppositions that are derived from historical or theoretical biased interpretations of what happens when you lack a state authority. The soak and poke method was perhaps the best that I could unfold, right? I've been really happy to see how rebel governance has become more systematically studied. I think there are limitations to some of the approaches that are taken today, but at the time, nobody was really trying to understand the real politics of Eastern Congo, right? Because it was thought that you could not access these zones. And therefore, there was a whole bunch of language about anarchy, about chaos, about, blind spots, black spots, like a whole terminology that was substituted for actual knowledge, right? And I kind of had, because I'd taken these anthropology courses, I didn't have the same antagonism to the idea that, I'm entering this space as an outsider. I don't have any sort of special information. I have some cultural and linguistic knowledge of the regions that I was studying. But ultimately, I'm going into this blind, right? And I'm going to lean into that and say, I don't need to have a foolproof research design that is tight from beginning to end, but rather that there is value alone in descriptive work, right? Even being able to describe that, hey, look, there is actually a school here. Hey, look, there's actually a hospital here. Hey, look, the rebels are running courts here. That in and of itself, I think, was a contribution, right? I was quite okay with that as being, the ambition of the project.
Yeah, I want to just flag the unusual confidence that it would have taken as a PhD student at UCLA at the time to say what you just said. And to, I think that's partially an answer to Christian's question and partially just something, virtuous about your narrative. The idea that you went in with the confidence to want to just describe things that you actually saw rather than what the discipline and the profession tells you to do, which is to make a theoretically informed test of theory. That's a big step, and not every graduate student in their mid-20s is prepared to do it because it requires an arrogance on the part of the author to, say the world should be listening to me. And I mean, arrogance in a good sense. So anyway, I don't know how to teach that, on my side of the desk. It's a very strange, strange thing. But I'm glad that you said something else though, and I want you to follow up on it, which is that you would not advise students to do the same thing today. And I'd like you to explain why. This was back when you were talking about the strategy of access. Yeah. And part of it, I think, has to do with the march of time. And part of it, I think, has to do with other changes to the profession. And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I mean, you've clearly given this a lot of thought. And now you're an advisor, too. So what has changed? Why do you think what you did would not be good advice And why do you think it still would be good advice, man? You run with it.
All right, so you're getting me into a reflective mode here. What I would say is that part of what you described as arrogance, and I don't think that's an inaccurate term, comes from a particular place, right? And that was that I was not a good student in conventional terms. Right? I don't think I questioned my intelligence, but I came to the country when I was 10 years old. My family moved to the Midwest. I was one of the only dark-skinned people in my classrooms. When I went to high school, which was a mostly minority high school, I moved to a bigger city. I was expelled from high school in my sophomore year. And it's not like I turned it around. I kept on getting in trouble, and that continued into my PhD era. My second year of the PhD, they tried to kick me out. And so I think that one advantage that I've always had is that I've always had very low expectations put on me, right? And there is a freedom in having very low expectations because I was constantly outperforming them. Like finishing high school was outperforming the expectations of my teachers and administrators in high school, right? Getting into college, finishing college, getting into a PhD program. At every step, I encountered resistance, some of it due to my own individual bad behavior. But I think what has come with age is sort of realizing is how much I was shaped by these structural forces, right? So when I was in India, for example, when I was growing up, I wasn't a troublemaker, right? I only became a troublemaker once I was racialized into the United States. And I didn't realize at the time. So you really lean into this characterization of being the bad guy, right? And I embraced that. And I think it created, a sense of sympathy and even empathy for other bad guys. Right. And I think that perspective is one that is missing a lot in the academy today. Like that's why when I work on groups, the rebels or social movements, even, my starting point is not like, how do I improve the state's response to these groups? My goal is not to help the state be a better counterinsurgent or a better counter protester. Right. Because many of the figures, and this was something that I got from going deep into Africana studies or Black studies, right, was a sense that, many of these figures who are being demonized by the state in a way that I could draw parallels to my own experience, right, were actually heroes to me. Right? I remember reading the autobiography of Malcolm X when I was 15 years old and feeling a very strong sense of identification and then writing a school report about it and getting a really bad grade on it because Malcolm X was, still a very taboo figure in the early 90s. Right. And that mindset of like saying, who else has historically been demonized by the state? Who else has been put into these boxes of being the bad guy? Right. But perhaps deserves more attention, not because I justify everything that they do or do I need to. Right. But rather that I want to start from the vantage point that the state itself is not always a virtuous actor and often, in fact, is the bad guy. And when you start with that perspective, then it's much easier to recognize that I don't need the perfect rebel, right? I don't need the perfect revolutionary. They don't exist, but they deserve much more understanding and attention, right? And so I think that is hard to teach because that's, nowadays when we admit PhDs, even when I started my graduate studies, there were a lot of older students, students who were like labor organizers, who had prior commitments, who had spent time in the real world. And by the time I finished my PhD, it was all 22-year-old math majors, right? They were the only ones being admitted to the program. And they were being admitted for a very different set of skills, very impressive on paper, right? I don't want to knock their significant quantitative abilities. But we are social scientists, and they seem to lack that social experience that I think was very important, to having a worldview, right? And I think oftentimes, especially in the political violence community, what that means is too much comfort with state power. Right, too much comfort with wanting to prove that your research is meaningful for the U.S. government, right, or whatever government that you proclaim adherence to, and I think that's really the main difference. Nothing specific. It's just that I had this wariness. I've always had this wariness of authority, and I think that those of us who study groups like rebels or oppositional movements of any sort, having that kind of oppositional mindset allows us to produce insights into their behavior rather than assuming that they're a problem that needs to be solved.
So I want to press you on something. Do you believe that the problem then is that the pool of students currently contains fewer deviants like you And so there's something that can't be taught, which is less likely to be in the pool of trainees that we would send out there? Or is there something else about the march of time that has made it such that the path that you took in the early aughts would be a bad idea now in a way that it wasn't then?
Oh, there's a third component. There's a third component, which is the faculty in the current institutions that are doing this recruiting.
Yeah.
The faculty have their bias, right? So it's like, we can't just blame the pool. It's the people who are selecting people into the program as well.
Yeah. I didn't say the pool is not created by nature. That wasn't the claim.
I think that, you know, let me just first express some sympathy for the position that we're all in, right? Which is that the academy is facing, you know, limited resources, you know, withdrawals of state support. All the money gets concentrated in a very small number of institutions, and the vast majority of academia is underfunded and looks to, you know, be on a perpetual death march towards insolvency. And so I think there are, you know, real market pressures that are driving a lot of this. And one of those is how do we transform the study of politics into something that is economically and politically viable in the current environment? All right. And so there's on one side the idea that if you study political science, you should leave with some tangible skills that will help you get a job. Right. And on the other side is that, you know, we should be, you know, training students to make a contribution, which is usually understood as supporting government, right, in some capacity, or improving government in some capacity. Right. Those are the tangible skills that theoretically a political science degree can offer. And I have a problem with that, right? Because I want to understand politics as something that extends beyond the state, right? I don't think we should approach the study of politics in a purely instrumental fashion, either in terms of the market or in terms of the state, right? I believe, you know, as I believe that all political scientists should believe, you know, that politics is, it infects every aspect of our lives. That politics is as meaningful to people who, you know, live in my neighborhood here in the Bronx as it is to, you know, elites graduating from Harvard. I think our politics generally would be a lot better if it wasn't so meritocratic. Right, it wasn't oriented so much around getting the best and the brightest, who are often completely detached from any sort of social awareness, and assuming that they should be the ones who govern us. Right, but it's hard to separate out, you know, that reality of where our economics and politics have taken the academy from this more almost naive, hopeful view that, you know, we can make the study of politics relevant to everybody. Right. And so I'm not, you know, I think we're stuck in this cage, right? That it's not a cage of our own making, but that we, as the sort of rats stuck in within it, are forced to respond to the incentives that we're offered. And that may mean, you know, taking money from the U.S. government if you want to study political violence. That may mean introducing certain kinds of, you know, very technical skills into the study of politics on the assumption that that will help somebody get a job at Facebook when they graduate. I mean, all these kind of choices that are being done. You know, without any sort of real kind of conversation, well, you know, let's get back to why it is that we were drawn to the study of politics in the first place, and what are the appropriate ways to go about doing that, right? Now it's like, well, okay, there's no jobs for political science PhDs, but you can go get a job in data analysis working for big tech, right? And isn't that good enough? And then my answer is no, right? We want political scientists to study big tech, not to necessarily understand their life's goal as being, you know, running algorithms for Facebook. I have more hope for our discipline, right? I have more hope for the academy generally than what we've allowed it to become.
This is fantastic. I want to flag one thing you suggested, or highlighted, which I think is incredibly important, which is the freedom at the bottom of the well. There's a bunch of people who enter the academy from distinct orientations, and the minute you made the comment about almost getting kicked out, it's just like, I remember Glenn Palmer and Stuart Bremer just like, you know, you should probably leave grad school, because I lost interest, because I gained interest in world systems theory over the Corliss of War project. And so that defection or potential defection signals something to them. But in their dismissiveness, I actually had a freedom with regards to I want to focus on this thing, state repression. I don't want to do interstate war. I want to do this thing, realizing that the background and connection with African American history just kind of led me in this direction, which is kind of like, you know, I don't really care what you have to say. But there's something to say. There's this isomorphic channeling of graduate students and this funneling thing that happens. And those of us that kind of fall out of it, either because we weren't accepted in it in the first place or seen as being willing to kind of like go along with it, or they didn't think we were going to be able to succeed with it, gave us some freedom to actually, you know, get out of the channeling and then kind of explore research questions that we wouldn't otherwise be led to do, which I think is also very important, right? There's a channeling component to graduate school, and it's harder to find that unique topic that's really different if you're being kind of like funneled along in the classes and the selection, all this other thing. So I think you saying that is incredibly useful. Also want to kind of like give props. I mean, like, so we're in East Central Africa around the same time. I'm doing Rwanda stuff, right? And like, I'm just like walking across the border in Lake Kivu to kind of like, oh, now I'm in Congo. Oh, now I'm back in Rwanda. Now I'm back in Kivu. And then saw the place and kind of going, okay, then there be dragons. And so I went back to Rwanda where it was orderly, right? Where I could kind of understand everything. So I just want to give respect for kind of like stepping into that environment. But it's really incredible to think about kind of like where you were coming from and where you were going into, and then just basically kind of like, let me see what is here, and the openness and the kind of strength and encouragement to kind of just figure out that. I mean, so is this like all you? You're all up in the space and you're just kind of like, okay, let me see what's here. Or is there some kind of like, what was your network of affiliation? Or you were just kind of like, so as a New Yorker, I feel great about the possibility. I'll walk into any place on the planet and be like, okay, what's up? And so you seem to have that same kind of attitude. It's like, okay, this happens to be Congo. Let me see what's going on. Or did you have some kind of like supportive intellectual or social or cultural network that got you into that space that was kind of like, all right, I'm here now. Let me see it. So did it take a village?
I think that, you know, so part of the reason that we need to be diversifying the academy, I think, comes from what is possible when you inhabit different kinds of bodies, right? And I think, especially political science, we've not done a very good job of recognizing how much experience can inform our politics or political realities, right? And I don't mean even at the aggregate level. I mean, even at the individual level. Right. So my family is South Indian. I look the way I do. You know, many people confuse me for East African. They perceive me as Ethiopian or Somali or from the Swahili coast. I studied Swahili, so I speak Swahili. And that very much informs how I'm perceived in many different spaces. Right. And there is a way in which, you know, I lean into those connections. Right, I lean into those realities, and that comes from personal experience as an immigrant moving to this country, and often being perceived as Black, right, and not, you know, first having to puzzle through what that means in terms of how I fit into American racial hierarchies, right, but then also understanding that, like, the claim about, well, you know, I'm not Black, I'm Indian, right, is problematic in its own way, that I don't want to have to do this work of reinforcing these racial boundaries that I find problematic in the first place, right? And that was something that I only gained from actually going into these spaces. So I would go into South Sudan and they would be like, oh, you're Kenyan. And I'd be like, no, I'm not Kenyan. And they would be like, yeah, you're Kenyan. You know?
Yeah.
Actually, Indian American. And ultimately, like, you can't argue it, right? Like, you can't. At some point, it's like, well, why am I arguing this? Like, you want to perceive me as a Swahili person? You know, I take offense to that. So hey, you know, let's go with it. And what does that mean to you, right? Like, how do you perceive the Kenyan role in South Sudan? Like,
right? I have a higher stakes escalation of this question though, and I've been dying to ask you this. What do you do when the identification comes from the U.S. government and the identification is as a terrorist threat to this country? Like, as a result of the work that you've done and the affiliations you've had, and, you know, probably the way you look, you know, you must have had a couple of close encounters that were coercive or at least had the veiled threat of it. So I don't want you to overshare if you don't want to, but... You know, you're making this sound very quotidian and friendly, and particularly because of what you do and how you do it, I'm sure that it isn't always like that. So tell us a story or two about that.
That's a, yeah. So what I would say is that it's really interesting, right? So on one side, you're absolutely correct. As a dark-skinned person who studies terrorism, you get racialized in very particular ways, right? And again, as I already mentioned, I started my PhD, 7 days after 9/11.
And it's I don't mean to cut you off, but it is just straight different for you than it is for me or Jake Shapiro or any number of other people who got started at about the same time.
Yeah.
Full stop.
And I think that the reflection to my work was reflective of that, right?
And I don't think Jake would mind me. And I don't think Jake would mind me saying that. Yeah.
I think it'd be ridiculous not to acknowledge it, right? How could it be the same, right? It's not like the U.S. is post-racial, right? It's a highly racialized environment. If you come from outside the U.S. and you come into the U.S., it's hard not to be astonished by how much race is so central to almost every aspect of life. Like, as I mentioned, I'm more of a Marxist, right? I'm more interested in class relations. But I think in the U.S. context and in many parts of the Western Hemisphere in general, I like Cedric Robinson's work. I believe in the concept of racial capitalism. I believe these things were intertwined, especially in the West, in ways that demand attention to both race and class as hugely important signifiers for how you move through the world. Right. And that's absolutely true for political science in the U.S., and I think especially true in the early 2000s, which was a time of exoticization, right? Exoticization of the other, especially in the field of political violence. And so, I was accused as a graduate student of being soft on terrorist groups, right? But the interesting thing, I think, again, is that it wasn't necessarily U.S. government people who actually had spent time in the field. Right. When I've spoken to the military, for example, so I have a policy where I will talk to anybody, but I don't take funds for my research from the military. Right. But I will speak to the military. And when I speak to the military, they're often much more open to the kind of frameworks I was advancing as a junior scholar than, say, white guy academics who study political violence and were much more, there was much more machismo in terms of how they approach the subject. Right. So they wanted to study beheadings and kind of the front lines of the war. And I was like, well, actually, the really interesting stuff, the really political stuff is what's happening, in these small villages. Right. And then when I would speak to, say, an army commander who had spent time in Afghanistan, they would have the same kind of analysis. Right. They may not be using the same language that I'm using, but they would emphasize the importance of popular support, of like winning over civilian communities. These were the kind of intuitive understandings of the on-the-ground dynamics that they wanted to foreground as well, right? But I've had some difficult times. I gave a talk once to an army audience, right, where I was talking about rebel governance and I was talking about, using the Taliban as an example and sort of describing, the efforts that the Taliban took to win over civilian populations within the territories that they controlled. And then a soldier who was in the audience who had returned from Afghanistan was very... I don't want to say he was offended by what I was saying, but he was traumatized, right? In the sense that he had lost a close friend to the Taliban. And so even as he was willing to concede the point that I was trying to make, he couldn't quite reconcile the anger and frustration he felt with the Taliban as an organization, right? And so I've always had to sort of thread that needle because, again, the way I'm perceived, it's physically, it could be read as an endorsement of these groups that I find heinous. Right. Even if I don't actually say anything that's like, glory be to the Taliban or to any of these violent actors. Right. I call myself a pacifist intentionally. It's a purposeful label in the sense that I would not choose to use violence to achieve my own political objectives. Right. And that, I think, is an important kind of position for me to come to in order to study those who do use violence for those purposes. Right. And so I think it's a very tricky line to walk in terms of how we engage with various types of powerful actors. But I would put both the U.S. government and these sorts of armed groups in the same box. Right. In either case, I don't identify with the U.S. government, nor do I identify with these groups. And I want to study them fairly and objectively, recognizing my own subjectivities.
Right. Actually, Yeah.
We should probably ask one more question about research in taking a step back from violence. So in general, what advice do you have for others who are engaging in data collection efforts, especially people who are going somewhere for the first time? So I think you had the advantage in your experience of going into a place that you had already dipped your toe into. And then you had an advisor who insisted that you do pre-field work. So I guess it's a two-part question. The first is, do you insist on pre-field work as an advisor? And when you're giving advice to someone who is going somewhere new, whose language skills are not as developed as maybe they should be, but they're going anyway, what do you say on their way out the door?
The first piece of advice I always give American graduate students is go and talk to local academics, right? Like, your first stop in any foreign country that you visit should be to the local university. And I'm shocked that I have to even say this, but it's been so normalized for Western researchers to plop in and not talk to any local
and not talk to local academics. Yeah.
That I will always start by saying that, like, go to the university, walk into the political science department, say, hey, I'm a PhD student at this university, and I was hoping to talk to so-and-so about anything. And my experience, because that's what I did, was to always be very warmly welcomed by these local intellectual communities, right? And again, you know, if you are, say, a white American and you have no language skills, and you may encounter some resistance, you may encounter some dismissiveness, right? Because they have been so acculturated into understanding their role as kind of glorified research assistants and socialized into believing that all Western academics want from them is to, you know, to treat them as labor to be exploited, right? But I think you can disarm them if you sort of start with the assumption that, look, I'm not coming here from a position of superiority, but as genuinely as a young student who wants to learn, and you are the people who have the most to teach, right? And my experience was that those, you know, relationships that I built with local intellectual communities were essential to everything I've done since, right? Even 15 years later, I still have relationships with colleagues at these institutions that come back into play, you know, now that I'm much more established in my field, that I, you know, if I have a project and I want to find a local partner, it's very easy for me to do that because, you know, now I actually have resources and I can share these resources with my local collaborators. And it's a really nice way to, you know, assuage some of my guilt about being based in the global north and a tenured professor and all of that, right? So that's one. I mean, but I think that the, you know, the bigger challenge that we confront is as a field is you know, I think that I was part of the last generation of academics who were not professional. Right. There was an assumption that, you know, PhDs could take 7 to 10 years, that you probably have a side gig or two while you're kind of working your way through the PhD program, that you have plenty of time to, you know, do a little bit of activism here, maybe make an album here. You know, I had friends who were DJs who were in the PhD program. Like, they were all kind of doing multiple things at once. And so the PhD wasn't understood as this professionalized space like law school or the business school, but rather as part of life. Right, and that life itself would inform the research, right? And I think especially if you are coming from, say, the United States and you're a U.S. citizen and you want to go and study these peoples off over there, it's very hard to do that in a respectful manner if you're, you know, if you have like a 2-week period where you think, now I'm doing field work, right? The pressure is too great. And so how do you then kind of extend that, recognizing the constraints that now we expect people to finish in 5 years, that at most they get maybe 1 year to do field work, you know, and can't have these sort of long-term, years-long relationships where they blend over. And so part of one of the advice I often give, especially being here in New York City, is like, start with the diaspora communities, right? Before you ever enter into the field, like, you know, if you want to go and study Ethiopia or Congo, I mean, it's not hard to access incredible figures who are, you know, maybe working as taxi drivers in New York City, right? Like, it's a stereotype, but it actually can be very useful. Like, if you go into D.C. and you get into a cab driver, you know, an Ethiopian cab driver, and you start asking some questions, it takes like 2 seconds to realize that, you know, they may have participated in one of the wars, that they have these incredible stories, and that they're often very, very willing and open to invite you into their spaces and share their stories with you. Right. And you can do that way before you actually go off to Ethiopia to go and study the rebels. Right. You can have this kind of contextual personal relationships that doesn't require any money. It doesn't require any advanced, you know, research. And you should do that. Right. Because it will change your life. It'll change your life in ways that you don't even expect. Right. Those kind of diasporic relationships that you can forge with people can be incredibly useful to you. right? And they give you a sounding board, right? Again, the question that I always ask grad students is, who are you writing for, right? Are you writing for American political scientists? Or are you writing, you know, let's say you work on Sudan, are you writing for Sudanese, right? And for me, like, as a scholar, my commitment from the very beginning was to say, look, if I'm going to write about Sri Lanka, I want Sri Lankan scholars to read this and then to say, look, I hate everything here, but he's not wrong, right? Like, I want it to be credible, right? I want to be engaged with their debates. I'm not trying to shape it. I'm not trying to push them in any particular direction, but I want them to say, like, he's not fucking bullshit, right? He's not just making stuff up because he's trying to, you know, fit the dynamics of this complex war into, you know, a language that American congressional scholars can understand. And I saw a lot of that around 9/11. I mean, when I was a graduate student, I remember going to a job talk where, you know, the scholar who was presenting was presenting on the Tamil Tigers. I just returned from northern Sri Lanka, right? And this guy had never been to Sri Lanka, and he wanted to apply the term outbidding, right, from studies of the U.S. Congress to the behavior of terrorist groups, right? And so he was describing the Tamil Tigers, and he was making elementary mistakes about the case. He knew nothing. Right. And I remember sitting there in kind of righteous indignation, watching him make all these horrific stereotypes about the Tigers and thinking that all my faculty members would have the same outrage. You know, and then the Q&A begins and all they do is just shower praise on him. Right. They shower praise on him for his like innovation in applying this concept from the study of an American Congress to explain the Sri Lankan conflict. Right. And I was shocked. We offered him the job, but he went somewhere else, right? Because he had multiple offers. You know, that was a very revealing moment because it was like, he is studying Sri Lanka to study America, right? It's not really about Sri Lanka. It has nothing to do with Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka is just, you know, a cipher for him. He can project onto Sri Lanka whatever the hell he wants to, even if he's making factual errors, basic factual mistakes, because nobody in this room gives a damn. And then it's not surprising that no Sri Lankan scholar would ever think to read that work, right? Would never even assume that that work is about them because it's not.
Because it's not.
That's powerful. Okay, so last one. So Zachariah, a common theme you're addressing is kind of like the local matters, right? My grandparents were from Foreigner Road, so I'm like, yo, BX represent. So, but from the consideration to the Bronx to consideration or interactions with like local universities, it's a common theme you have, which is kind of like immersion within the kind of local community. And I want to frame this in part because we kind of forget that we are the academy, right? It's just like, okay, there's this thing out there, but we're also in it. We constitute it or we can destroy it. And so I'm wondering what kind of balance you suggest to the grad students or the people that you interact with, because you could push on the old and be like, no, the local matters, or you could just work with the new. So one, I'm kind of like, what balance do you advocate, or does it shift across one's career? And second, what trick do you have for kind of like helping the old to understand that the local matters and they should be immersed in understanding, not just the local where they're studying, but also linking where they live with where they're working and making that connection? Because you kind of internationalize the local in a sense, which I thought was very powerful. And what suggestions you have for working with the old to kind of hint this to them, and also working with the new? What kind of tricks or suggestions do you have for that? Sorry for a big one.
So I think, you know, in terms of the question of like, how do you reach different generations, right? So I'll be clear, like I benefited a lot from an older generation, right? The folks who got their PhDs in the 60s and 70s. Dick Sklar, who was professor emeritus at UCLA, by the time I arrived there, he was on my dissertation committee and he was a hugely influential figure for me. And I think a big part of that was that the ethos was very different for that generation. So Dick Sklar, again, I think is a really interesting figure because he was on the founding faculty at the University of Zambia. Right. So from like 1961 to 64, you know, Kenneth Kaunda invited him to come to Lusaka to set up the University of Zambia. And he was like the first chair of the political science department there. Right. And that kind of experience was fairly common amongst that generation. Right. So people now will probably be in their 80s. You know, they would have these much more kind of substantive relationships with the societies that they studied. You know, and that was just kind of the default understanding, right? Where their relationships were hugely important to how they did their work. And then I was at UCLA precisely at a point where they were kind of being viewed as dinosaurs, were being pushed out. Some of the younger faculty would tell us very explicitly, don't bother working with these kind of figures. They don't have anything to offer. They're all dinosaurs. They're clinging to these old ways of doing political science. It's no longer rigorous. I was a weirdo, so I sought them out, right? I found them to be much more compelling. And I think we are kind of coming around in some ways, right? That there is a sense that, you know, we've lost our ability to do that kind of deep historical contextual kind of work. And that produces all kinds of very substantive mistakes, right? Like, it's interesting watching the kind of mea culpas that are emerging now around Afghanistan 20 years later. Right. It's really interesting to watch a lot of these figures who, again, I've followed them for the past 20 years. I saw how they used the war in Afghanistan to advance their careers. They took on all kinds of questionable roles. I mean, American academics were writing the Iraqi constitution. They were advising the U.S. government on Afghan policy. And they all spectacularly failed, right? And it's interesting to see which of them actually use that as a moment for reflection and which of them are just like, you know what, this does not taint me at all. Because they're correct, right? The ones who say, like, this has no impact on me, they've all risen higher and higher within the academy, right? But I think that there's this disconnect now between, what we thought of as, like, doing meaningful work in the academy and recognizing that a lot of people with very big positions really gave bad advice to the U.S. government across two decades, right? That many of our best experts led the U.S. government down some very dark roads. And I don't think there'll be any accountability, but I think in the court of public opinion, there has been a shift, right? And that is validating in some ways, because I was always skeptical of the coziness that was involved, right? This idea that using some sort of specific sets of fancy methods could allow us to transform entire societies, right? That we would, just because we've now advanced far enough in our kind of understanding of social science, that we could remake Afghanistan in a way that was different than when the Soviets tried, and it's different when the British tried, right? To me, it always seemed like a failed enterprise, and more problematically, as a political scientist, something that could taint our discipline, in the long run, right? And so I don't know what this moment heralds. I don't know if we really are going to have a reflection and a dialogue in the field of political violence around what went so wrong and what was our own culpability in facilitating this abomination called the War on Terror for the past two decades. But I think that there is more skepticism outside of the academy, right? And I hope that can kind of bring back into fashion, more respect and attention to these older ways of engaging with societies, which I'm not trying to romanticize, right? But just to say that at a very basic level, you know, if we had a different set of paradigms governing how the social sciences were conducted, maybe we would have come to different conclusions, right? And maybe we would not have been so gung-ho about supporting this global war with no end, you know, that has transformed entire societies. I mean, it's distressing. I work on South Asia and Africa. Like, they have been remade in the image of the war on terror, right? And there's never will be any accountability for that, at least at the governmental level, right? Maybe as intellectuals, we'll see some of that. And that may, I think, so one thing, let me end on a hopeful note, right? I think the one thing that gives me hope, and this has been true my entire career, is that my work has always been better received by young people than it was by the powers that be. And I think, especially amongst, you know, assistant professors and PhD students right now, there is a lot more attention to issues of subjectivity, of ethics, trying to understand how a relationship to powerful actors, whether that be governments or international agencies or corporations, right, in a way that was just completely absent when I was a PhD student. Right? And that, to me, is a very heartening thing, and I hope that it leads to a shift in the mindset so that we move away from this fascination with, you know, objectivity and science, you know, scientism, as I would call it, and more of a recognition that we too are political actors, right? And that as such we have agency and responsibility for our actions.
I share that hope. I know Christian does too. Zachariah, thank you so much for being with us.
This was great. Thank you so much. It was a real privilege to be on here with both of you.